From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for August 20th, 2021. Your division-leading Milwaukee Brewers are home this weekend with the Washington Nationals. And also this weekend, Milwaukee's Irish Fest will be the first ethnic festival of the season. Break out the corned beef and Jamesons. Okay, so who's Don Gorski? Well, Don set a new world record, and wait till you hear what it is. He's been eating at least two Big Macs a day since the 70s. And in 2016, he set a world record of eating 28,800 of them. And he's still at it. This year, he just topped 32,000. And anyone remember this? Two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. We all used to sing that, didn't we? Hey, speaking of world records, a woman from New York set a world record by running 100 miles in 22 hours on a treadmill. Her new nickname is Hamster. NASA is now the pizza delivery service, but unlike Domino's, they're not guaranteeing delivery in 30 minutes. Astronauts on the International Space Station aren't getting pizzas. They're just getting the ingredients, and then they have to bake it themselves. What a jip. You think Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson could have dropped one off? Shopping for a cemetery plot? For $1.2 million, you can be buried between Hugh Hefner and Marilyn Monroe. Man, the housing market really is crazy. And finally, our stupid headline of the week comes from the Utah Herald. Self-proclaimed invisible man, a no-show at court hearing. On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Paige Ratke, Joel Dreising, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
How do they know?
Thanks as always, Max. A rough week overall for the markets, although we finished strong today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 1.1% this week. The NASDAQ down 0.7%. And the S&P 500 closed today at the bell at 44.42. That's down 0.6% for the week. For the year, though, the NASDAQ still up 14.6%. The Dow up 16%. And the S&P 500 up 19.3%. All of those including dividends. So overall, despite a bit of a rough week, you know, still a great year for stocks. Dave, as we look at some of the trends this week, an article in the Wall Street Journal pointing to maybe a sign that investors are more willing to reach for potential yield, more willing to reach for potential returns than what we might otherwise advise. But, you know, you look at the junk bond market right now or high yield bond market, a little maybe less derogatory to call it. And, you know, we're seeing record issuance or a record pace of issuance from new issuers in the junk bond market at a time when high yield spreads remain near historic lows, when overall rates, however, also remain pretty low. It seems like investors are finding some opportunity there.
You know, Kyle, it's really kind of an interesting viewpoint, I guess I'd call it, of people's tolerance for risk when they get fatigue set in by these low yields for so long. I really think it's pushing people into areas that they, you know, recently would never have ventured into. And I really think this really brings a good conversation into view about risk in general. And that is, you really need to understand the risk of an investment before you make a decision to participate. And beyond just understanding it, I think it's also then important to evaluate, am I being compensated properly for the amount of risk that I'm taking? And I can say that it's hard for me to get excited about the risks involved in the high yield market to make 4.5%, which is what this recent issuance was averaging. To risk your principal at those kind of returns is really hard to justify. And so I just want to caution investors to keep patience with your, you know, traditional portfolios, your bonds that you've come accustomed to owning, the high quality side of things, and stay the course. Don't fall prey to this reach for yield. I think part of the things we're seeing this summer with cryptocurrencies and meme stocks and other, you know, failed derivative products. I think it's all a combination of the fact that people have for so long now been pressured to reach for something that they're just not comfortable with.
I think what's so interesting about what you pointed out, you know, you mentioned cryptocurrency specifically. We're now seeing the potential for approval for some exchange-traded funds based on cryptocurrency. And so often when we talk to clients, what we see is that rather than them finding things they want to buy or finding things that you know, really fit neatly within a portfolio that's designed for them, they're being sold things or they're being marketed things. And I think what's happened is that the industry as a whole, our industry, unfortunately, has latched on to some of these trends, whether it's high-yield bonds because investors are looking for a little more yield, or whether it's cryptocurrency because it's in the news all the time, and trying to create product that they can market to people that otherwise may not have a role in a lot of portfolios. And so I think understanding risk is key on the high-yield side. You know, you point out that 4.5 or 4.6% average yield that these current issues are being issued at. And I think the reality is that's a cap to the upside, right? You're not going to get better than that because that's what a bond does. You pay 100 for the bond, you get 4.5% each year till it matures. And when it matures, you get your $100 back. And, you know, you contrast that with the unlimited potential upside of equities. You're taking similar risk in the high-yield bond market, maybe not quite the same, but certainly similar when you look at the experiences of the financial crisis, you look at the experiences of other periods of market stress. High-yield bonds fall almost as much as stocks do, and yet they don't have the same kind of upside. And so if you're talking about what the role is in your portfolio, I think you rightfully point out you really need to understand the risk you're taking. And I think as we look at 2021, the summer of this year, it had kind of been deemed a summer of travel. Certainly we've seen you know, pretty significant issues if you're trying to rent a car, pretty significant issues if you're trying to find a hotel in some certain hotspots. But we're also seeing some news that maybe, you know, the hot travel demand has been pushed into 2022 and beyond as well. You look at supply and demand imbalances across the board. Joel, I know it's something that you look at. We're seeing it in the housing market. We're seeing it in the labor market. We're seeing it really really across the board. You know, what kinds of things, as you look at the economic data, are you seeing?
We had some numbers this week on retail spending, which is something that's very important because we know that 70% of our economy is driven by consumer spending. And, you know, it continued to show that people are still spending more than they did before the pandemic started, which is great. It's still growing, but it also was down from the pace that it was in between June and July, and it's been down two of the last 3 months. Number of things are going on there. I think supply and demand is part of that. A couple of the areas where we saw sales drop off were car dealerships. You know, we all know that the whole kerfuffle over the chips has caused a shortage in some supply of cars, and that's been slowing that end of retailing down. Another area that took a back step in July was home building centers, and part of that is sort of seen as a repercussion of how expensive prices housing is getting. The National Association of Realtors said that in July, the median price of a house was $363,000, up 24% from the year before, both kind of record highs. So, you know, supply-demand there, where we're seeing a lot of people wanting to get houses, and there just aren't that many for sale. We also had numbers on housing permits and housing under construction. We saw that the single-family houses under construction, that's back where it was like 15 years ago. It's been up 13 out of the last 14 months. That's going great guns. But the number of permits was up for the first time in 3 months. The number of new starts was down. So we're seeing some mixed results there.
And on the unemployment front, the leading, or rather the initial claims for unemployment back to near long-term averages now, which is, I think, a pretty big step from how bad things had gotten maybe 18 months ago or a little less than 18 months ago now.
Right, and we're, you know, that's something where we're still going to be seeing some things happen because we're still not back to the number of jobs that we had before the recession that was caused by the pandemic. We're like 7.5 million short based on some economic projections of what we should have, you know, if we didn't have that recession. At the same time, and I know we talked about this on the show last week, is that the output of the economy is back above where it was before the pandemic. So we're putting more out with fewer people working in jobs that might, you know, bode well as far as productivity is concerned, which is good for the economy. It's still early to call that, but the trend is in the right direction. And you still have to figure out, you know, the people who still, the 9 million people who are still unemployed looking for work, how they fit in and what they're going to do.
You know, Joel, what I think is interesting about what we talked about last week, and we had another, I think, pretty meaningful story this week on the productivity front, is that when you look at long-term economic growth, it comes from two areas. It comes from growth of the workforce and or it comes from productivity growth. And we're in a period of time now where the demographic shift in our population is not going to lead to significant growth of the workforce. And so economic growth has to come from productivity growth. We had Elon Musk in a conference this week for Tesla talking about essentially the fact that physical work in the future will be a choice. It won't be required because we're creating the ability or we're developing the ability to take a lot of those jobs and give them to robots, turn it over more fully to automation than what we've ever done in the past. And so I think you go back to the 1960s or 1970s, these are stories that were being written even then about how the work week of 40 or 50 years from now would be 20 or 30 hours and we'd have all this leisure time. Well, yeah, maybe we found some other ways to spend our time. I think the reality, though, is that when you look at you know, what Musk is trying to do for Tesla and other businesses, we really are trying to improve the productivity of workers. And I think, you know, one of the things I talk about, Paige, a lot with clients is the pandemic forced a lot of that, that there are things that we needed to accomplish as a workforce, whether it was allowing for more remote work, whether it was creating tools to better access, you know, necessary work product. All of those things were forced upon us within the last year simply to keep up with the demands of our jobs amidst the pandemic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we're talking about productivity gains, there it's kind of twofold, right? Because on one hand, you have the productivity in the manufacturing department, and, you know, not to put too much emphasis on what Elon Musk has to say, but just the expectation that in the future, manual labor is going to be a choice. And so we always talk about it as though that means that people are going to lose jobs, but really what that means is that people are going to have more time to do other things. So as we start to get more productivity gains within the manufacturing, within the construction, within all those sides of the fields, that opens up more people to start doing more of the service businesses, which, you know, United States has moved more towards a service-based economy, which in theory, you know, increases the labor force working on those types of things. So, you know, like you said, as people have worked from home, not only has it been work productivity and sort of finding the ways to make that work, but even just personal productivity, you know, the ability to switch the laundry load on your lunch break, the ability to wash the dishes, and all those things that free up the time to do things like spend your money at the store and the restaurants and things like that.
I think the other side of that, of course, is wage growth. And we've talked for years about how stagnant wage growth has really been, you know, even going back to the 1990s at this point, where wages just haven't kept pace for most workers with corporate profitability, or they haven't kept pace with markets more broadly. And I think that's left a lot of workers behind. But what we tend to find that it has really two significant impacts. One, wages themselves can rise pretty drastically with productivity gains, that if one worker can put out twice as much, you can afford to pay them twice as much. Now, as a business, you're probably not going to do that. You're probably going to pay them 50% more, and the other 50% goes to
further defining or further developing that technology. And so I think, you know, some of that should result in wage gains for those employees that are left. The other part is inflation, that if you can be a more productive business, you can better manage the potential detrimental impact of inflation on your products. And so some of that is keeping wages in check. Some of that is more efficient uses of your resources. And so I think productivity growth really is the piece that I hang my hat on as what's going to carry us out of the recession, what's going to allow the markets to continue to move forward from here.
Kyle, that potential for wage growth hits at something too. I mean, you talk about the recession and the pandemic and how that might be goosing some more productivity in our economy. It also might be giving workers a little more leverage. The fact that we have a lot of job openings, more job openings now than we have people looking for jobs, says something that maybe the workers are going to gain more of an upper hand and get those wages that will help make them, and it's better to be operating a machine than doing the manual labor that machine is taking the place of. The other thing I wanted to point out was, I read that Elon Musk made an appearance with a person, a worker, dressed as a robot. So we're not quite there yet.
Well, Joel, I think that's the right point, and worth pointing out to our listeners that if you just look at the picture of the presentation that Musk did, it does appear as if he's with a human-looking robot. Now, if you watch the video, however, it's quite clear that he's with an individual and not an actual robot. And so I think you're right to point out that this isn't all here yet. That a lot of this is where can we head, whether it's, Boston Dynamics and the robots that they've built, or whether it's Google and some of the automation that they've been able to put into self-driving cars, for example. These are all things, I think, that are meaningful steps towards what the workforce of the future looks like.
And Kyle, I think it's important to point out too that the stock market is a forward-looking indicator. So like you said, we're not quite there yet, but market movers are already looking at those things and trying to figure out what kind of value is that going to add to these companies and trying to price that into today. So, obviously if we don't meet some of those expectations, we might see a little bit of a pullback, but long term, we're going to start to see some of those benefits, at least in the stock portfolios, hit sooner than you might expect.
Kyle, a real important missing piece to the improvement in productivity is cash, right? For corporate America, for global companies around the world to have the ability to invest in those areas. And fascinating that this week came out through all this second quarter results, gleaned out the information that right now global balance sheets, corporate balance sheets hit an all-time record, $6.84 trillion. Sitting on balance sheets and cash and short-term investments. To put that in perspective, that's a 45% increase over the pre-pandemic five-year average. I mean, we're talking about a lot of cash. And doesn't mean it's all going into research and development, of course, but the good news is the money's there, and it can be allocated to some of that type of innovation, which is important.
And perhaps to bring this full circle, a lot of that cash has come from very cheap borrowing. And so when you look at issuers in high-yield debt, first-time issuers in high-yield debt, they've borrowed a significant amount of money. But even companies that already had a lot of cash over the last 5 or 10 years have been issuing debt because they can do it cheaply. They don't need to worry about paying it back anytime soon because they can just keep refinancing cheaply. And so what you have is, I think, a lot of cash that you can put to work in the kinds of things we're talking about. Dave and Paige, one that hits pretty close to home for me, and I think maybe a bit of a public service announcement, just a reminder for our clients on beneficiaries, right, that you get a lot of advice or you read a lot of advice online about what you should do, who you should name. I know we've had this conversation on the podcast before, but maybe if one or both of you could walk me through just some of what you tell clients about how to name beneficiaries, about who they should be talking to, and what kind of information that they should be making available as we kind of look at, how do we want to leave behind our assets to best help our heirs, to best help those that might be receiving things?
I mean, at least for me, the number one piece of advice that I give is clearly lay out what your intentions are. You might get some advice from an estate planning attorney or your neighbor or, you know, anyone out there who's going to tell you what you should do. But the question is, does that actually get you to what you're trying to accomplish? And oftentimes, you know, things can become very, very complicated. But if your goal is to pass your assets to your two children, make it as simple as that and name your two children as your beneficiaries. You know, there's a lot of this that can become very, very complicated. But the simpler you keep it and the more that you review it and make sure that what you have on paper actually fits what you ultimately want to have happen, I think that's the most important piece about it.
I can't add much to that, Paige. I think you hit the nail on the head. And I think if I was going to reiterate one point is make sure that your wishes are current. If we ever see problems with clients, it's when they fail to update their wishes. And we can't read minds. And so if it isn't what you want on there, you need to tell us. And you need to make sure that those people that are listed are truly who you want to see your assets go to.
Yeah, I know a conversation about those things tends to be a part of our review process. And so for clients listening, certainly make sure that those are questions you're asking or questions you're having answered, even if you're not asking them by your advisor. When you're in the office, when you're on the phone with us, I think, you know, there are reasons why you want a really complicated beneficiary designation, and there might be something you need to do with attorneys to help lay that out. And I think you rightfully point out, oftentimes the simplest solution, oftentimes the one that most clearly encapsulates what it is you're trying to accomplish are going to be the best ways to go about that. So I appreciate that insight. Well, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.